behalf of Bob Bingham, I'm going to do the introduction. So audience, viewers and listeners on Zoom, welcome to today's seminar, to the special oral lecture given by Professor Kevin McFarlane from Rochester University and the University of Geneva. So we'll have 1 hour presentation and then followed by half an hour of coffee, tea and questions just outside. So Professor McFarlane received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 1994. And as a young researcher, he followed a rigorous career path and received many grants and awards.
He became a Lederman Fellowship at Fermilab, then was promoted to assistant professor in 2002 and became a professor in 2005. He's a fellow of the American Physical Society since 2005 again, and currently he's working on the T2K experiment at JPARC in Japan and at Icarus and the Dune experiments at Fermilab. With his T2K collaborators, he's a recipient of the Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics in 2015. His research interests are in the field of experimental high energy physics, and his primary study is in the field of neutrino properties and weak interactions. So today, we are pleased to welcome Professor McFarlane and his lecture on looking for electrons in all the wrong places. Over to you.
Okay, good. Can you hear me well enough? Great. Okay, so my purpose today is to tell you a little bit about an experiment that we ran for almost a couple decades, as you'll see, at Fermilab, called the Minerva experiment. And one of the features of this experiment is that it ended up with very high statistics neutrino samples. So as a result, one of the things we can do with the data that we have is we can look for processes that are very much subleading in this beam and try to make sense of them. And so that's the lecture today, is looking for the presence of electrons. So very briefly, because I don't know how many of you work on neutrino physics, I will have a little overview. Actually, does everybody here work on neutrino physics? No. Okay, good. Then it's worthwhile. So the big purpose, right, the reason we're building a number of neutrino experiments and that these facilities, like the one that this experiment ran at, exist, and the reason for these studies fundamentally is we're trying to do neutrino interferometry. So the idea is that you start with a neutrino of a given flavor, so associated with a charge current weak interaction that produces also a muon, you have a muon neutrino. That neutrino may or may not be in nature, in fact, we know is not in nature, a single mass eigenstate. It's a mixture of mass eigenstates put together. And so when you produce that neutrino, you produce different mass eigenstates. They evolve somewhat differently in space, according to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and they pick up relative phases for each of the different mass eigenstates, even if produced with the same momentum, because they will all have slightly different energies. So that phenomenon leads to an evolution of the flavor properties, if you project from the mass space back to the flavor space, of the neutrino beam over time. So you can start with a beam, for example, of electron neutrinos. You can start with a beam of muon neutrinos. In this example, it becomes an electron neutrino and then can oscillate back to a muon neutrino, and so on and so forth. And so this allows us the possibility that we can measure how the different mass components make up the flavors, how those are related to each other. And it gives us the possibility that we can measure the masses of the neutrinos. In fact, it's the only non-zero result test that says that neutrinos have any masses associated with them at all. So one of the strange things about this field, I'm telling you, we're doing experiments at Accelerator, but one of the strange things about this field is that because of some number of lucky parameters, we actually made the original discoveries in this field 25-ish years ago using neutrinos from natural sources, so from the sun and from cosmic rays. And it just so happened that the pattern of neutrino masses and mixings were such that those signals were very, very large in those experiments. You could see nearly 50% of the neutrinos changing flavor over some average. And so that allowed for at the time it didn't feel fast, I can assure you, but it allowed for a relatively quick and a relatively easy discovery of these phenomena. So the challenge in front of us is to try to learn more about these phenomena. So we know things like, for example, from those natural source experiments that there's two different mass differences, but we don't know the ordering of those masses. There may be two light and one heavy, or there may be two heavy and one light, for example. We know that some of the mixings are large, some of them are somewhat less large, without going into any detail, that's represented by that small bluish fraction of one of the things of jelly beans up there, illustrating the mixtures of flavors inside each mass eigenstate. But one of the things that may happen in nature when you have three states, we know in analogy with the CKM matrix that you can have a CP violating phase. And so one of the things that's possible is that there's a matter-antimatter asymmetry also in the mixing of the lepton system. And that may, in principle, be related to matter antimatter asymmetries that exist in the universe, which of course are very large. Otherwise, you might get a lecture from antimatter Kevin, and that would end disastrously, differently disastrously than this one will end. But anyway, so what are the measurements that we want to do? So the transitions that we want to study precisely in future experiments are few percent flavor transitions, and we want to make measurements that sort of schematically look like this. If we're looking for CP violation, it's helpful to measure neutrinos and antineutrinos separately. And there are two main effects, one of which comes from this ordering of the masses and the way that the neutrinos interact with the matter as they go from the source to the detector in the experiment over a long distance. And that separates the two different colors of ellipses here. And then you also want to measure where you are on that ellipse, because that gives sensitivity to the CP violating parameter delta. So the idea is to make some moderately precise measurements of these relatively small mixing parameters using neutrinos, which are, of course, very difficult to work with because they hardly ever interact. And there are some other challenges that I'll mention in this talk. If you want to read more about the work of Minerva, it's all about what those challenges are, essentially. So the idea is that we have this tool for discovery if we can just make these precision measurements of neutrino interferometry. We can look for CP violation in leptons. We can look for symmetries in the patterns of masses and mixings. And this is a compelling future science program that's making us want to build some big experiments. And to do that, we have to make these precise measurements of neutrino flavor transitions. So the experiments that are being built look like this. This is one that's called the T to hyper K, or just the hyper K experiment. So the idea is to take the successful T to K experiment, which took a beam of neutrinos from the east coast of Japan to near the west coast of Japan in a big water detector under a mountain, and scale it up, make a bigger detector, run the accelerator hopefully a little more than it runs now, and run it at higher intensity. And basically try to repeat that experiment, which has a little bit of a hint of this matter-antimatter asymmetry, and try to do it with overwhelming statistics. So that's one of the approaches. A different approach is the DUNE experiment, which is being built in the US. The source is a new beam at Fermilab. The detector is a new detector underground in a mine in South Dakota. This is actually a smaller detector than the Hyper-K detector, which is a somewhat unusual choice. But the reason for doing that is to build a detector that is very precisely sensitive to all the ionization for neutrino interactions, and to give it more capabilities to resolve things like the energy and the flavor of the neutrinos. So those are the two main main ideas. And just to make the point about what it is that you're measuring, up here, well, I guess it's on both sides, isn't it? I was going to say on my right, your left, but you can take your pick, is a plot of the Dune neutrino spectrum, and superimposed in it for some different choices of parameters are the probabilities for neutrino oscillations. Actually, do I have a pointer? I don't know if there's one here. Maybe I don't really need one. It'll be fun. So you can see different curves there. And one of the things to notice is that the oscillations, the Fourier transitions occur actually at different energies. So it isn't just a simple counting experiment the way I made it look in that original slide. It's actually measuring transition probability as a function of energy. Okay. So these experiments, as I mentioned before, are done taking a beam of muon neutrinos and looking for them appearing as electron neutrinos. And remember, this is a seminar about electrons, if you can remember back all the way to my title slide. So the idea is we have to make some number of measurements of electron neutrinos, but we have a problem in doing so. So the accelerator experiments that we build that make the GeV energy beams that allow us to study these oscillations are almost entirely muon neutrino beams. That's good in a sense, because it means that if we're looking for electron neutrinos, there's not a big background, but it's bad because it doesn't actually let us study the interactions of electron neutrinos. And you might say, okay, Flavor universality, standard model, what am I actually worrying about? It turns out I'm worried about a couple things. Great, it's that, okay, wonderful. I'm worried about a couple things. So one of them is that the muon on the scale of a GeV neutrino is actually a fairly massive object. And so what that means is that if you look, for example, in a space of, if you look in a space of momentum and energy transfer, there's simply a bunch of space that isn't there for the muon neutrinos that is for the electron neutrinos. So if all you study are the muon neutrinos, you never have access to that and you never get a clean measurement. And so you're doing some sort of theoretical extrapolation in the rates. There are other things that come in. There are potentially different nuclear effects exacerbated by this problem. And there are radiative corrections that are different because the lepton masses are very different. So all those things come into effect, and you're basically relying on theory unless you can make a measurement. So part of the idea of this is to ask what sorts of measurements can we do in an experiment like MINERVA. So I should tell you about the MINERVA experiment that I've alluded to and what it is that it was about and what we were trying to do. So MINERVA was an interaction experiment. So it was designed to study neutrino interactions, not neutrino interferometry, not neutrino oscillations. And it ran for about a decade at Fermilab, mostly in the 2010s. And the design was fairly simple. It was build a relatively capable, cheap detector, put it as close as possible to the world's highest rate GeV neutrino source, and just measure a lot of interactions. And a couple of other features that aren't so important for this talk are that we actually put several different nuclear targets in the experiment so we could measure the nuclear effects that disrupt things like energy reconstruction and so on. But that, again, not the point of today's story. So one signature of the experiment that is important for today's story is that because we were a relatively large, I mean, not by neutrino experiment standards, but many tons of target material experiment, and because we were so close to the source, we have enormous neutrino samples to work with, many millions of events. And that is unusual in neutrino experiments. Okay. So I don't mean to discourage any of the younger people in the audience, but sometimes it takes a while to do these experiments. And there's a couple of reasons that I want to make a point about the history. So I appreciated the reference to my young career. I guess in my young career, which probably isn't anymore, I one of the things I did is I wrote the expression of interest for what eventually became this experiment. I wrote it in 2002, and this timeline goes out, you know, a couple of decades before we get to the peak of publishing the bulk of our data. And it took us a while to build the experiment. Neutrinos take a long time to accumulate in a detector like this, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot going on. One of the things that happened along the way is a lot happened in neutrino science, in interferometry, and then that helped us to set and understand our goals. So at the time we designed this experiment, we didn't actually think that a precision nu mu to nu e experiment was all that important necessarily. I mean, maybe it would be, but we didn't know. We didn't know what experiments would become important. But because of work beyond the original discovery phase, like work from the Minos experiment, T decay, NOVA, the reactor measurement of the theta-1-3 mixing angle, so on and so forth, the importance and the goals became far more clear in the experiment, so that in the end, we were able to, as these goals became more and more clear, sort of tune what our objectives were. And that's what led to this work. Just on a personal note, lots of other things happened over a decade. So this is my youngest child, my daughter, at the time of the ELI, and she's now a music teacher in an elementary school in the Washington, D.C. area. So, you know, stuff happens. Okay, so what's the cheap detector that we built that we put so close to the beam? It's basically a big chunk of scintillator with some calorimetry on the outside. And some of the calorimetry will become important later, so I'll mention it. Calorimetry is very simple. It was just lead sheets in between planes of scintillator. And it's a relatively simple scintillator bar. It's read out with vacuum photomultipliers. We kind of missed the solid state revolution by about a year as we were doing the construction planning, but is what it is. Just a very straightforward detector design. But again, fairly big and sitting close to this very intense beam. Remember, in a neutrino experiment, you're trying to capture everything you can get, and the interactions just occur anywhere inside this detector. So we're focusing on events that have electrons in their final state. A lot of them are fairly in the forward direction. And so we're looking for the interactions of those electrons in the scintillator, which then spill into the electromagnetic calorimeter. If you knew where the interaction was, this isn't the detector that you would build, of course, to measure an electromagnetic final state, but you need the target material mixed in. So it's a somewhat suboptimal detector in the, you know, if you're doing a collider experiment, you wouldn't design this. Let's put it that way. That detector, as I say, ran until 2019. It's mostly in trash cans. Hopefully it ends up, it's mostly polystyrene. So hopefully it ended up in takeout food containers and lawn furniture and things like that. Some of it got recycled for tests for the Dune experiment. The beam that we sat in is a conventional neutrino beam, meaning it's produced by protons striking a target, making primarily pions, which decay to muon neutrinos. That's why it's predominantly a muon neutrino source. And we ran in a couple of different beams with different focusing configurations to give us different energies. So that's another useful thing about the experiment. Okay, so I promised to talk about electrons. Actually, is there a clock? Okay, fantastic. I promised to talk about electrons. So what gives you electrons in a primarily muon neutrino beam? Well, it's either the beam or the target, right? So the target, of course, has electrons. The problem with the reaction on the target electrons is that it has a very small cross-section. It's about a part in 10 to the 4 compared to the cross-section on the carbon nuclei in the scintillator. So fine, that's one thing that you could look for, but you have to have the expectation that it will be a rare reaction. The other thing that's true is that that beam, when it produces neutrinos, muon neutrinos from pion decay, it also produces muons in that pion decay, and those muons themselves can decay, and they make a roughly 1% component of the neutrino beam at low energies. There are other processes that dominate at high energies, but for the moment, I'll think about the lower energies of the beam. And so we get also electrons from that source. Here, in fact, is the spectrum of electrons from that source. So it's sitting here at a little bit lower energy than the dominant muon neutrinos. By the way, I should add, this beam was run in two configurations, either focusing positive or negative pions, therefore giving you neutrinos or antineutrinos. And we chose between the two and took a lot of statistics in both. Now, of course, because this is relatively rare, you could imagine that there might be other things that are going on. People have imagined there might be other things going on. So if you made electrons or photons, generally speaking, you would find them in these samples, even if they were made by exotic processes. And there are ideas about how that might be useful. Remember, we're taking an enormous number of protons, slamming them into a target. We could be making all sorts of things. The conventional mesons that are made could decay into exotic things, and so on and so forth. So maybe this is a fruitful place to go looking for things like that. Okay, so if we're looking for electrons, how do we go about doing that? So electron showers, which I've slightly obscured in this diagram, which is perhaps not optimal. Anyway, electron showers basically look like a cone of energy that's not consistent with a minimum ionizing particle, leaving a single head as it goes. So they spread out a little bit in the plastic. Those same showers will, of course, tick up when they get to the electromagnetic calorimeter and start leaving more and more energy. And so it basically just looks like a splashy wide fat track, but very easy to distinguish from a muon. That's not a big challenge for the experiment. What's more of a challenge is that you produce a lot more neutral pions than you do electrons in a neutrino beam like this, made from muon neutrinos. And so those neutral pions, of course, also decay to photons, which look very similar to electrons, and you have to have some way to separate them. You separate them by looking at the energy deposit right at the start of the shower. If it's a single electron, you'd expect a peak. If it's from a pair conversion, you expect a peak at a roughly twice that energy. So in principle, that's relatively straightforward. There are a couple of complications, actually three of which I want to point out on this plot. So one is that the electrons here in orange in this simulation spill over from the peak over to here. That happens because the electrons start showering, right? And so if it starts showering, it's going to have more energy deposit near its start. And that just happens sometimes. That's how nature is. Another thing that happens is you have photons sitting here that end up under the electron peak. Why does that happen? Photon goes to E plus E minus pair. Sometimes that can be a very asymmetric pair. All the energy can go to an electron or a positron, almost all. And so you get this happening. And again, there's nothing you can do about that. Every detector that's trying to do this sort of experiment has this problem to one degree or another. So we always have to deal with the backgrounds. Then the other thing you might notice about this plot, which is a little bit weird, is here's data. There are error bars on this data, but I told you Minerva had overwhelming statistics. And here's our simulation prediction sort of out of the box, and they're in terrible agreement. Okay, so that was one of our early mysteries as we started doing this, and I'll come back to that mystery. Actually, I'll come back to it very quickly. So here's the way that we do the separation. And you can see again, you know, it's not even close. So what's going on? It turns out that there were some processes which are essentially, it's a very weird process. It's a process that's either coherent on nuclei or can happen on protons. It's effectively a diffractive-like production where the neutrino comes in, it emits a W boson. In this case, this is the charge current, but in a neutral current, it would be a Z boson. That boson, that weak boson in the field of whatever the target is, without disrupting that thing, converts itself into a quark anti-quark pair, which appears as a high energy pion. I usually use the analogy that it's like shooting a bullet at a bubble and it turns into a flower or something like that, right? The kinematics seem very weird, but it's actually comparable in rate, especially at high energies, to the electron-producing processes. So, which might be surprising, but it turns out that's the way nature is. And what was going on in our original attempts to measure this was essentially that we had a terrible model for that process. And so we struggled for a while as an experiment to understand what was going on. And as I'll come back to in the end, if there's time, it turns out that this process just was not well modeled at high energies at all. So we had to go and basically measure it and try to figure out how to account for that. Okay, so what I want to run through are a series of measurements in some degree of detail, one of which is completely new. Actually, I've not shown this to any audience at all. It's in preliminary form. So the lucky few in the audience will get to be the first, and very much interested in feedback because there's some weird stuff. All right, so neutrino electron elastic scattering. So this is something that one of my students decided on a lark to go try to do. I, as a terrible advisor, tried very much to dissuade him from doing this and failed, and it turned out to be a great measurement. So what's the idea? The idea is that if you measure neutrino electron elastic scattering, it gives you a unique window into the flux of neutrinos in your experiment, because you know what the reaction is. You can calculate it in the standard model. It's two fundamental fermions scattering off of each other. There's nothing really unknown. It's predicted to a fraction of a percent. But what is not known are the number of neutrinos that create that reaction. So by measuring it, the concept is that you can measure the flux of neutrinos. And so the way that this analysis goes is fairly simple. It's one of these fat tracks from an electromagnetic shower that you have that looks something like this, except because of the kinematics, it has to be going dead forward. There's not much chance to exchange a lot of momentum with that electron, right? And so because it's going dead forward, it's much easier to deal with the backgrounds. When we started looking at this, I again thought this was completely hopeless, but these are the final results for the experiment. The signal process is in the red and also the light blue here, depending on the flavor of neutrino, the type of neutrino that's creating the reaction. And you see, if we just look in this angle variable, yes, there are some backgrounds, but there's a huge peak of this process. And so we demonstrated that this was actually a viable technique for constraining the flux. Here's the same picture now in this variable DDX that I described before, same one as before. And you can see the photon peak cleanly separated from the electron peak. This one is going to look a little nicer than when I start looking more inclusively at electrons being produced, but you get the idea. So we were able to measure the spectrum of these electrons. That gives us a very significant flux constraint. And in the end, what we were able to do was to take our uncertainties in our flux and reduce them quite significantly through these measurements. So these were the a priori uncertainties in the antineutrino beam. Here it is after, significantly reduced, similarly in the neutrino beam, to the point where these measurements are giving us a sort of 4 to 5% constraint on the number of neutrinos. They also told us something that we weren't expecting, but is probably consistent with the uncertainties with which we could predict our flux a priori, which is that the flux is about 10% lower than we thought it should be, 10 to 15. So that was not necessarily something that we expected to come out of this. So this technique is very useful for high energy neutrino experiments generally. So it actually turns out that it's part of the backbone of the way that Dune will understand its flux is by making exactly this measurement. And we've thought about what the statistics are, which will be yet again higher in the future Dune experiment. And so it ends up being very valuable. And so this was one of these little engineering things that we did, but it was our first foray into electrons. So then, you know, like always happens, you have some moderate success and you think, oh, I'll just keep going. And this is how we, you know, get, I'll pick a random example, rock bands from the 70s continuing to perform today. So, but anyway, so we went on and we thought, well, if we can do this, probably we can do more general interactions of the electron neutrinos, and maybe we can do it fairly precisely. So the next story I'll tell you is about doing those measurements. Okay, skip ahead there. So again, a reminder, we're looking at about a 1% flux component. And so the idea is that you use these same algorithms that I talked about to identify the electrons. You look at the backgrounds the best you can with sidebands. I didn't emphasize it, but you have a little component of antineutrinos in the neutrino beam and neutrinos in the antineutrino beam that you have to deal with. but you can use the measurement of one beam to subtract that component in the other based on the prediction. So you do that. You can then measure the cross sections of those electron neutrinos. And importantly, because you're trying to ask the question, is it the same as the muon neutrino? Can I shed any light on this problem I mentioned before? You want to take the ratio, but you want to do that accounting for the different fluxes. So this is the physics, the fairly ambitious physics program that we set out to do. And I'll give you some highlights from that program. So again, fundamentally, the background subtraction comes about because you're looking for this separation in DEDX. And the photon backgrounds kind of fall into two categories. One would be ones where a bunch of other things are produced in association with the pi zero, but the others are from these diffractive or coherent processes that I mentioned before. And so the idea was to separate them and to use that predictive power. So what's shown here is a function of the transverse momentum of the electron, because now it's not just going dead forward. It can have some scattering angles, some transverse momentum. And this is in one of our beams, our different sidebands, different regions before any tuning is done. And I already telegraphed the reason that this agreement is terrible is that we have a bad prediction, effectively, for the coherent and diffractive processes off of hydrogen and carbon. So these are two selections for the hydrogen and carbon, and then this is the incoherent production. The signal component, by the way, is the orange shown here. So the signal component continues also to be a complication. But basically, we use these sidebands to tune the background. You can see that the agreement was absolutely terrible. We were having to increase things. This green component, we ended up having to increase by about a factor of 4 or 5 because the model was just completely wrong about the production. But you can see that we were able to get a good description of the sideband data with essentially tuning the reactions to what we observe. And so this is the signal. It's certainly not background free. It's sort of 1-to-1 in the neutrino sample and maybe 2-to-1 in the antineutrino sample. But because of those sidebands, we can get a fairly reasonable prediction for the backgrounds. Okay. I mentioned the wrong species problem. So the neutrino beam has this little bit of antineutrinos. The antineutrino beam has a larger bit of neutrinos. Again, because we measure in the two beams simultaneously, we can just effectively convolve those two together based on the flux prediction and make the separation. And so here are the details of that, which I won't run through. So in the end, we're able to make the measurement. This is on a log Y scale here as a function of how much other visible energy there is in the detector. So things like protons and pions that are produced, we measure as a function of that visible energy in different bins of the transverse momentum. So this is getting a little wonky, but the point is we're trying to probe the space of interactions. Visible momentum, you see that we're able to measure a cross section with some fairly decent precision here. One of the features of this cross section is has a peak at zero. That peak at zero in the antineutrino beam is because one of the dominant reactions is antineutrino comes in, takes a proton either in the hydrogen in the target or the carbon in the target, turns it into a neutron, and you get an electron in the final state. Okay, so that has zero energy other than the electron, and therefore gives you this peak here. And you can see relative to this model that's been tuned on muon neutrinos, it is in, at least in reasonable qualitative agreement. And we did the same thing in our neutrino beam that doesn't have this peak at zero, so not shown on a log scale. So you get an idea of how well we can do this. Okay, the important thing to do from here, as I said, is we want to know the question, is there any difference that we can see in the muon neutrino and electron neutrino cross sections? So the logical thing is to take the ratio to the well-measured, very high statistics muon neutrino cross sections, but easier said than done because the fluxes are somewhat different. of the two. And so you have to decide how you're going to account for that. So here is the ratio of the electron neutrino flux to the muon neutrino flux as a function of energy. And you can see it has a highly non-trivial shape here. It averages at about 1%. The peak of the beam is here. But on the tails, you get a proportionately larger electron component. So this presents some challenges, right? If you're going to try to correct for this. In particular, energy smearing, you know, you don't perfectly measure the neutrino energy. That's kind of one of the points of our experiment, is that you don't perfectly measure neutrino energy, certainly not in a model-independent way. And you can see these slopes are actually quite large. The advantage is we're making a measurement that integrates over all the flux, so some of these effects become a little bit more manageable. But we realized pretty quickly, because this has some model dependence, we were going to have to take two different approaches. So one of which is to just try it and accept the fact that we have a little bit of model dependence. And the other thing to do is to just not correct the ratios for the flux and just show flux integrated ratios to different fluxes. So that becomes a little more difficult to interpret in a raw way. You have to do some more work to understand what the data is telling you. But we ended up doing both. And I think it's probably best if I just gloss over some of the details and show the results. So here is the flux corrected ratio, where we've taken our prediction for the electron and muon neutrinos, and we've made that correction. So the answer should be very close to one. The Monte Carlo is incredibly confident that the answer should be one, if you look at the error bars here, with very tiny errors. We have fairly small uncertainties. There's some significance. Excuse me, systematics to worry about. But you can see that we're actually in the realm of probing this at the few percent level, which is great. And the agreement, again, is qualitatively good. There are, you know, some little things you might look at carefully. Is there anything going on here? Is there anything going on here? But it's not dramatically far off, right? So you might think that maybe we've basically confirmed that the two cross-sections are similar. We've done the same thing with the unweighted result that I told you about. Here, of course, the flux ratio is about 1%. So the value comes in at 1%. What happens here is that you get much smaller experimental uncertainties because you're not building in these model-dependent effects. But again, it's a little bit harder to interpret. And I'll leave the data to speak for itself as to whether there's anything that isn't consistent with the simulation. Not evidently, anyway. And again, we did the same thing for antineutrinos with very similar results, although here there's something a little bit different. So recall in the antineutrinos, the cross-section is much higher near zero visible energy, these points here. And so you get larger uncertainties just from statistics out here. But one of the features is that, especially at this low momentum, there's actually starting to be a little bit of a hint of a discrepancy here. And that would be much easier to see in the antineutrinos than it would be in the neutrinos. So I think it's the sort of thing that once this data is published, we'll go back with models. We'll try to see if any of the ways that the cross-sections could be different might be consistent with the little hints that we're seeing. Another thing you might notice about this, though, by the way, is that on average, these are maybe just a little bit higher than one than you might have expected. So... and I'll come back to that point in just a minute. All right, so that's essentially the bread and butter physics that we wanted to do. And then again, you know, as that rock star that started in the 70s was maybe still going okay through the 90s, gets up to the 2010s, wants to keep going, you think, ooh, what else could we do with this sample? What else could you do with this sample? You had a lot of electron neutrinos and a lot of muon neutrinos and a prediction of what they are. Well, you could go looking for neutrino oscillations, couldn't you? But unfortunately, Minerva is a single detector experiment, right? So in a typical neutrino oscillation experiment, you take your neutrino beam, you measure it in a new detector, you let it oscillate, and you look for the oscillations between the two detectors. We don't have anything like that. Right. So the working title of our paper for this, by the way, is Why You Should Never Do a One Detector Oscillation Experiment. We'll see if the editors of PRL like that. Okay, so what's the idea? Well, the idea is to take this same data that I just described and to look at it as a function of energy. If that's all we were doing, that would actually be a little bit boring. So let me explain why it's not completely crazy to try to do this, maybe only moderately crazy. We have a bunch of samples that I've shown you that are actually kind of interesting for this measurement. So one of them is you have a sample of neutrino electron scattering events, right, which have really no interaction uncertainties. So they're purely sensitive to the flux. We also can make very high statistics samples, certainly compared to competitor experiments, millions of events of the, tens of millions actually, of the muon neutrinos and many tens of thousands of the electron neutrinos. And so we end up with very high statistics. But one of the things you can do is you can actually, you know, consider the ratio of those two things, right? So that would be another way to get away from uncertainties in neutrino interactions, is to take that ratio. So what would oscillations do in an experiment like Minerva? Well, if you had nu mu to nu e flavor transition in nature, it would make a much bigger impact on the very small electron sample than it would on the very large muon sample. And then it would do something in between for the neutrino electron scattering sample. If your neutrinos were disappearing into some sterile state, you know, then you just see disappearance in your samples at whatever level nature tells you. And there's sort of a funny thing. We're actually sensitive to oscillations to tau neutrinos. And that's because tau neutrinos appear in this neutrino electron scattering cross-section. But we're not very sensitive to tau neutrinos because we only have a couple thousand of those neutrino electron scattering events. But that's sort of a weird curiosity. So I probably shouldn't bore you with this, but maybe just to show this. So one of the things, I'll explain it. So one of the things that is true about the electrons and the muons is they're actually not produced at the same point in the beamline. So picture of the beamline here, right, is pions are produced here, they're focused, there's a long decay pipe. The pions predominantly decay here near the beginning. The muons, of course, are very long-lived. They predominantly end up in the beam dump and don't decay. But the ones that do decay that make neutrinos that you see are coming from the downstream part. So the distance that they travel, and the oscillation effects go as L over E, the distance that they travel is actually different. So one of the slightly weird things about this experiment, if you do it as an oscillation experiment, and let's say take a look at this one for delta M squared of 10 electron volts squared, the muon neutrino oscillations and the electron neutrino oscillations are just completely different. By the way, one thing to notice about this, there is wiggly oscillation behavior here, but it's kind of muted. And one reason that it's muted in this prediction is that the neutrinos are being produced all along this beamline. So it's a range of different Ls. So that's sort of the nature of what we can do on the experiment. The analysis proceeds in very much the same way as what I just described. We use DDX to separate them. The other thing that we do is to get away from interaction systematics, we restrict the sample to a relatively small amount of other things in the neutrino interaction. So we're looking for the events that look pretty elastic because their cross sections are better known. And then we want to get rid of the neutrino electron scattering thing that I just crowed about, right? Because that makes a background. So we require some transverse momentum. And really that's the only cuts in the experiment. So here are the DDX curves in this oscillation search. They look very much like what you've seen before. They have a little bit now of the pre-tuning baked into them, but not much. And so you can see the two samples, the forward and the neutrino dominant and the anti-neutrino dominant samples. The electrons are sitting here. So backgrounds, but not uncontrollable backgrounds. And we use, again, the same technique of the DEDX to control it. So here's what this looks like for the first time as a function of energy. So what's shown here are the different samples for different energies. Now, this is very low energy. This is where we don't really expect to see very many events at all. Certainly no, we don't have neutrinos here, basically. And so you see nice, pretty well-described photon contributions, but none of the orange electron contributions. As you march up in energy, you start to see more and more of the electron contributions. And then at high energies, electrons completely dominate because you don't make very many pi zeros. So as we vary in energy, one kind of undesirable feature, if you're doing an oscillation experiment, is that the signal, the background, changes a lot, right? So something we have to be conscious of when we do our measurement. Okay. So again, a reminder of the samples, neutrino electron scattering, and then these two samples, the very high statistics muon neutrinos and the electron neutrinos that we could consider in a ratio that we're going to use. All right, so you are the first audience to see this. Here's what we see. So here's our neutrino electron scattering sample. This is our muon neutrino sample. That exponent is 10 to the 6. So we have, as I said, a lot of neutrinos here. Muon neutrino sample. Here's the electron neutrino sample, and here's the ratio of the muon to electron neutrinos. And I'm deliberately not showing you things in ratio plots between the data and simulation yet. There are ratio plots here, but they're actually the antineutrino to neutrino dominant beam, and then the flavor ratios shown over here. Okay. So if you stared at that, you could start to see some things that don't look like awesome agreements. I can highlight them for you if you don't like the eye test. So one of them is that there is sort of a level disagreement here and a little bit of something that looks kind of like wiggliness in the muon neutrinos. So that is there. The electron neutrinos are kind of interesting. So look at the prediction of the simulation here and look at the data. And there's a very, you know, good agreement here, but at the lower energies, there's actually quite a large excess on this falling edge. Everyone should be very suspicious of an excess on a falling edge, right? But it's there in the data. Can't really deny that. And then if you take the ratios here, which have different falling edges for the muon and electron neutrinos, so again, something to be aware of, this ratio is the nu mu over nu e. You can see now this excess gets transformed into a deficit because this is in the denominator, and it really is there in the ratio. It's not, doesn't go away. So what do the systematics look like? So things like the difference in the level here have very large systematics associated with them, the neutrinos, the antineutrinos, and the muons. And similarly here. But these flavor ratios that I showed you actually have quite small systematics, particularly at the lower energy. And that's because there are cancellations both in the flux and the interaction uncertainties. And one of the other things is that the double ratio here has particularly low systematics, for what it's worth. Okay. So I should finish within like 5-10 minutes at most. Yeah? Okay. So this is the point where one should emphasize that we've been careful. Okay. So what are the sorts of things that you were worried about, your systematic uncertainties? Well, certainly flux. We better have treated that correctly if we're doing an oscillation experiment. The electron identification, we probably should figure out a way to test that. And then the electromagnetic, magnetic energy scale, we probably better get that right because we're looking at an excess and a falling edge. So this is to assure you that we've done our homework. And I'll go a little bit quickly. So one of the reasons that we look at the flavor ratios so carefully is that the way that you produce the muon neutrinos and the way you produce the electron neutrinos are very closely related to each other. This pion makes a muon of a certain energy, right, and a neutrino of a certain energy, and then you get the three-body muon decay. These are very similar energies for the muon and electron neutrino on average. So it's really the same particles that are producing those neutrinos. And that's why if you look at all the ensembles, we use a multi-universe method for our flux estimation. It's not worth detailing. But you get very large uncertainties in the raw fluxes But then in this ratio of nu mu to nu e, the uncertainties collapse very significantly because of these correlations. So as far as we can tell, that should be pretty solid. You might worry a lot about this subtraction. So for example, how do I know that the photons that are asymmetric pair production that give you low DEDX are accurately predicted? It turns out to be really difficult, even despite what I told you about the rareness, to find an electron-free sample to do this on that doesn't also have other particles on top of your neutral pion. So the sample that we found are very weird events. They have very high angle muons. They produce a pi zero and almost nothing else. That's not a super common topology if you're looking for multi-GeV pi zeros, right? So we did go looking for those. And fortunately, Minerva has, as I've said before, overwhelming statistics. So here's our sample. The red is the background we're looking for. The electrons are the orange and the blue. These are things that are neither, they're not electromagnetic. They're typically pi pluses that shower in the detector and then give you neutral pions in the shower, right? But fine. So here's that sample. And if you look at the DEDX spectrum, it's fine, right? And within our systematic uncertainties, this is a perfectly good description. The one thing about this is that it's a better test at lower energies. So this is up to 5 GeV, say, than it is at higher energies, because you just run out of these events. They're very, very rare to produce a high energy pi zero and nothing else in a charge current event with a wide angle. Just doesn't happen. But this is where the backgrounds are biggest. So, you know, we evaluate ourselves as having passed that test. Then the last thing is the electromagnetic energy scale. So one of the things we see is that we're wrong on a falling edge. If we had the energy scale wrong, we just shift the prediction, done, no problem. So fortunately, we have a lot of neutral pions, and we can form the two photon invariant mass peak from where we resolve both photons in a pi zero decay. So here's sort of what you might think that mass peak would look like. Here's what it actually looks like. And there's a couple of reasons why it looks like this. So this terrible long tail is mostly because it turns out that plastic doesn't make a very good electromagnetic calorimeter, right? Or plastic then followed by plastic interspersed, you know, plastic scintillator with lead, or traditional calorimeter. It gives you all sorts of horrible nonlinearities. It's not really optimal for measuring it, and your resolutions aren't good. Okay, so that's just how it is. But if you look in the data and simulation on this high-end tail and near the peak, it's actually very good. This is a different matter. So the agreement here is not perfect, but actually what's going on here are two things. If you produce the pi zero at a very large angle, which is a physics model dependent question, then the photons go out the side of the detector sometimes and aren't cleanly captured. The other thing that happens, and again, it's correlated with the kinematics of the pi zero, is that sometimes you swap energy from one photon to another. And if you do that, you shift the mass peak lower. So if we look within our systematic uncertainties, we believe these little differences here are pretty well explained. And this is the one that's reliable and, in, you know, really a probe of detector resolution. So as far as we can tell, it works. We've divided the sample up in energy the best we can. We run out of statistics at high energy again. And, you know, the data Monte Carlo agreement between the true pi zero mass peak and where our peak sits, I mean, there are some nonlinearities here, but they're well modeled by the Monte Carlo, as far as we can tell. And then the last part of this is that we have these two parts of the detector, the plastic tracker and the calorimeter. And we have to check that the energy scale is the same in the different parts of the detector. And we actually found we made a mistake here. We miscalibrated it. But we miscalibrated it in data in Monte Carlo in exactly the same way. So here is a fraction of the tracker energy, the data in Monte Carlo, and they're not, at one, it's not flat, but they sit on top of each other. So we're not going to go back and correct it, but it looks okay. And the sorts of uncertainties that we're applying right now are 2% on what I've shown you. These blue bars are 1% scale uncertainties for these two effects, the overall uncertainty, and then the extra uncertainty in the calorimeter, everything's covered. I mean, this doesn't seem to be a problem. So, the next thing you might ask is, I've shown you these little hints, and I'll wrap up quickly. Is any of this evidence of short baseline oscillations? We don't think it is. Okay. So here's what the data looks like once you remove. So the way we actually do this is we parameterize our flux uncertainties, and we actually do a fit. We profile over those uncertainties, and then we have the remainder of the uncertainties due to interactions and detector energy scale and things like that. So here are the muon neutrino events, the electron neutrino electron scattering with no uncertainties now because we profiled out the flux are here. These are fine. Now you notice, of course, there's a big difference in the level here between the neutrinos and the antineutrinos. I didn't, my bars disappeared. Oh well. Between the neutrinos and the antineutrinos that are here, but that's completely consistent with the interaction uncertainties. There's no problem at all with that. But here's this persistent effect that remains a little bit outside the error bar, well, quite a bit outside the error bar, actually, of this these extra low-energy electron neutrinos. So these are the muon to electron neutrino ratio, and you can see low energy is here, high energy is here, that this is a low-energy effect. Now, when you try to fit it with oscillations in a standard picture where they should have an L over E dependence, they don't fit. It doesn't look like it has a 1 over E dependence at all. So this would be the best fit to oscillations. It's very low delta M squared and crazily large mixing angles, but it still doesn't really improve the description of the data. So there's no evidence that we can see that we're seeing oscillations, but we also have no idea what this is, this low energy excess of electron neutrinos. So you can go through the usual step of setting limits. I won't spend a lot of time boring you with those. I'll note one thing. Our limits in some cases are a little bit better than you would expect. And one of the reasons is that this excess of electron neutrinos means that you significantly favor a disfavor a disappearance of electron neutrinos because you have some extra ones. So our sensitivity and our limits don't match perfectly at all values of delta M squared, but that's how it is when you have a little unexplained fluctuation in your data. So this is in different panels, we're sensitive to all sorts of mixing angles. In a 3+1 scenario, different panels of U mu 4 is our limit shown here in UE 4 space versus delta M squared. And then another way to show it, and our limit's the blue. I need to say one thing about this. So this curve is actually a new limit from the Katrine experiments. I don't know if anybody saw this paper. It appeared within maybe the last couple of months. But the limit curve that we put here, we weren't quite sure which of their curves to use. They have one that assumes that there is no primary effect from the Katrine experiment, which is looking for a neutrino mass and beta decay. And that's the curve we picked. Probably the one we should pick is the one that's a little more ecumenical about what might be causing it, because oscillations would cause a cancellation. That actually makes this lobe sitting here go away. For the most part, it kind of just fades off in that direction. So Katrine will absolutely win at high delta M squared, but we have a region where we actually do a pretty nice job of ruling out some parameter space, probably all to ourselves. Here's the same thing in some fixed slices of delta M squared. Now it's the electron mixing angle and the muon mixing angle. This, by the way, for comparison, is a recent measurement by Microburn. So high statistics are helpful. All right. I don't have time for my last topic, although I've referred to it, so I'll skip to it and just come to my conclusions. So we've measured a bunch of processes, kind of had fun doing it, with electrons in the final state, where really you shouldn't expect a lot of electrons from a muon neutrino beam. We've prototyped this flux constraint method with neutrino electron scattering for Dune, and I think been quite successful. We have some interesting results when we compare electron neutrinos to muon neutrinos. We interpret it first as a cross-section measurement, and that's something that should appear in publication fairly soon. And it's really the first precise measurement anybody has done. And then I led you down a little garden path that we've gone on, thinking about some non-standard explanations and whether there's anything in our data. And at the low energies, we find something we don't understand. So, and then finally, I've talked a little bit about these interesting backgrounds that we had. There's actually some physics there to explore that I'll put in the slides if you end up posting them. We don't have time to go through them today, but that's been an interesting adventure as well. So I hope you've enjoyed our little trip through electromagnetic final states where you shouldn't have any electromagnetic final states. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. We now open the floor for any questions here in the room or on Zoom. We are please ask your questions in the question and answer. Or raise your hand on Zoom. Yes. Just a minute.
A fascinating talk. I'm a mud-slinging peasant when it comes to this.
Yeah, sling, please. That's why I'm showing you this.
No, I definitely don't understand. So for separating, is it possible to use time-of-flight measurements for separating electron and muon neutrinos just so that, there's a clear distinction?
Yeah, so the masses involved are far too small, unfortunately. In fact, So first of all, it would be decomposition into different mass eigenstates would give you the different propagation speeds. And what would actually happen, I showed you this picture of the coherent, staying as one wave packet, the phase separation. If you actually had a time of flight difference and they spatially separated, then obviously that interference effect would just go away. You'd be looking at pure mass eigenstates. Now, you would see a change in flavor from that. So if the masses are actually high enough, you could see such a thing. But the problem is we have a GEV, many GEV neutrino beam. So those masses would have to be many tens or more of mega electron volts, not probably a parameter space that we're so interested in. But I will tell you, it is something that we've thought about, and the beam has a little RF structure, and you can actually go look to see if anything fills in that RF structure that suggests something might be going a little bit slowly. That would probably be the more, that would be the stronger test. Wish we had another army of people to work on the Minerva data. We might get that one.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. This was lovely. This is perhaps quite an ignorant question on regards to the neutrino oscillation stuff, because you're right in the sense of doing it with one detector seems crazy.
Like a terrible idea, yes.
But the NUMI beam has quite a few detectors in it.
It does. So
is there any way that you can use some of the other detectors to improve your measurement?
Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't thought very hard about that. So the way in which you would do that is you'd look at detectors that have that are different angles, right? So you might try to compare electron neutrino rates at Minerva and Nova and even Icarus, which is very far off axis, and try to do something with that. I think it's a really intriguing idea. I haven't thought through how that would work. Certainly the precision cancellations that we have would not be a thing in that type of analysis. But if you were looking for a large effect, you might be able to find it with something like that. It's a good idea. And we should try to figure out some way to do that. Seems hard. I mean, one thing we'll do with this data is we'll release it in the rawest form we can. You know, here's our prediction of the flux. Here are all our uncertainties. Here's all the data. Have fun with it. And it would be great if somebody picked up a project like that, because I agree, that's a really interesting test.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're coming to your electron excess low energy. One of the things you were testing was the DDX.
Yep.
And I was just left wondering whether there could be processes involving a muon and a proton that didn't appear to be in your diagram.
Say more. Muon and proton and...
Muon and proton and not very much else. I mean, you can kick a proton.
That's our dominant reaction, right? We have many, many of those events. The proton is very unlikely to look like an energetic, well, a couple of things. So first of all, the spectrum of those knocked out protons is fairly low energy. The kinetic energies that you get sort of end because the form factor falls off at maybe 500 MeV, they're basically gone. And we're looking for many GeV products. So at those energies, if it's some hadron, it doesn't really matter what hadron it is. Any strongly interacting thing that's a GeV can make a neutral pion along the way as it goes through our detector, right? Doesn't really matter. It's any particle. And so when I showed the predictions for that sample, that looked like basically everything went to sleep. So I showed this sample here. This was the test, the DEDX, that black background, right? So that's all things, it's mostly pi pluses, but it could as well be protons contributing. All things that produce a pi zero in some secondary interaction end up there. And the DEDX is confused sometimes because it's something that's not ionizing very much and then it produces this pi zero. Sometimes there's a gap. So it doesn't do a great job of reconstructing those. So that's probably the biggest caveat.
I wasn't meaning producing a pi zero, and I was meaning directly confusing the proton for
zero. Yeah, but we just don't, that the way that we would do it is to go through the production of the pi zero or just have some showery thing. Maybe it could be many pi pluses and minuses produced as well. We don't produce single high energy particles that would easily be confused except by that mechanism of making the pi zeros, because we're looking at multi GeV things. So
okay, and sorry, since I've got the microphone,
no.
The next slide where you were trying to argue that the pi zero energy resolution energy calibration was good.
Yep,
I didn't really understand you. You demonstrate that the low energy tail is not well reconstructed, and isn't that a problem for your low energy tail?
Again, we don't think so. So the thing I don't have on this is a clear demonstration of what the systematic uncertainty effects are. But what dominates that tail for the most part is, as I said, things where energy goes out the side, and that's not what we're seeing in these events because we force them to be in the detector. But it's a good point, right? We could just take a know-nothing approach and say, what if that? Right? What if we had a tail we weren't modeling that looked exactly like that? Throw it in as a systematic. It's a really good idea. We should probably just do it. We're quite confident it's not going to matter, but we should just do it. It's a good idea. Thank you. I'm obviously workshopping this. This was all a bit of a surprise when we started looking at it a couple months ago.
We are short on time. Maybe just one last question. So, we are curious what your reviewers would comment as well. And sorry for the ignorant. Is there a success? So you found some interesting results?
Yeah. Maybe.
Is there a successor? And should such an experiment exist in the future?
So there's a couple of ways to answer that question. So all this data that I showed you is from one of the two, the higher energy beam at Minerva. We have a lower statistics, but not low statistics, sample of lower energy neutrinos. So we are absolutely going to, and we're in the process of reproducing this analysis with that beam. And so we'll see that beam peaks in exactly the region of our low energy excess. We haven't looked. We don't know. I don't know what it looks like, but clearly that's a study we should do. So Dune can definitely do this, right? It can look for these electron neutrinos, see if there's any distortion of the spectrum. And importantly, it can kind of do the study that we were just discussing, right? It can look at the detector in different locations, because one of the Dune strategies is to move its detector, its near detector, off axis and change the spectrum. So that's probably the best test I can think of what this is. And then finally, the BNB, the booster neutrino beamline at Fermilab, has made measurements of this, will continue to make measurements of this. I will point out that I didn't invent the term low energy excess in this field. That's often used to describe the result of the mini-Boone experiment. In fact, I started using low energy excess for our stuff basically to tease my graduate students when this result appeared. So I guess maybe the experiment's already been done. So, but Dune should be able to knock this out of the park. I mean, that really would be a great test.
Okay, thank you very much for everyone joining the lecture today. Let's close now.
Thank you.